This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What's happening, Beck?
What's going on, man? You taunting any other NBA players today? Tweeting at anybody? Trying to rile anybody up? Make yourself the story?
I don't taunt any NBA players. I don't go at... This was not taunting. This was... All right, let's bring it to wait to reintroduce this right away. So to bring,
We'll get to it.
I was going to ask you. I was going to actually compliment you on your show last week with Paul Pierce and Grant Hill. You jumped the shark there on me. You decided to jump on me quicker before I could say something nice about your show and ask you who you have coming up this Friday.
I am nothing if not an ungrateful co-host. Thank you. Grant Hill, Paul Pierce were a lot of fun last week. Different kind of show for this week. I'll be speaking with Dan Grunfeld, son of Ernie Grunfeld, of course, former GM of the Knicks, Bucks, and Wizards. Dan Grunfeld, who's had a cup of coffee in the NBA after playing at Stanford, has a book out about his family's roots and them surviving the Holocaust, which is what allowed Ernie Grunfeld to be an NBA player and later GM in the first place. It's a fascinating story. Dan and I will talk about that, but also I think we may get a few minutes of Ernie Grunfeld on the call with us as well. So that'll be on Friday, of course, on The Crossover.
All right, check out the Friday version of the podcast right here on this feed as well. So to now address what Howard brought up at the very top of the show, I was watching the Rockets-Celtics game last night in Boston. And in the third quarter, the wheels came off the wagon for Houston. They got blown out in that period, wound up losing the game by double digits. The 15th consecutive loss for the Houston Rockets, which is bad. It looks worse when you look at their bench and see a former all-star point guard sitting there in street clothes. John Wall, who has not played a game this season, according to the Rockets' mutual decision between the two sides, has been traveling with Houston, has been practicing, I guess, with Houston. Steven Silas said some things about Wall being useful to players in practices and team meetings, whatever. But he has not played for Houston. And I just couldn't help but wonder and note the weirdness, Howard, of the situation with Wall sitting there. So I tweeted out, it's just a bizarre situation. Wall is with the team. Wall is in uniform. Wall is not playing. And I said, I don't know how this is good for the Rockets or John Wall. The Rockets obviously don't get the benefit of having a high-level player in John Wall on the court. And John Wall both doesn't get to play and doesn't get to boost his trade value potentially by playing. Well, Wall kind of took note of that. He tweeted at me that he wasn't in uniform for the game. Then later subtweeted somebody else who suggested that this, Wall's being punished for something that's out of his hands, which I thought was kind of interesting for him to say that, because all along we've been led to believe that the situation with Wall and the Rockets was a mutual decision between the player and the team. So I guess let's start there. Rockets loses at 15 in a row. What do we think, Howard, of this Wall situation with Houston? We talked about it last week, but here we are once again, back to a strange place.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, he's a former All-Star. I don't know that he's ever going to be an All-Star again. Is he a better point guard than their other options? Young guys like Jalen Green and Kevin Porter Jr., who neither of them might actually be a point guard long-term.
Correct.
And whatever John Wall is post all of those injuries and all of that miles, he's probably a better point guard than those two, right? Not a better overall player, maybe, or won't have the future that those guys have. They're a lot younger. So your thing is he would make them better right now. He would stabilize them. And all I can say to that, Chris, is they obviously don't care. It's not the goal. And as much as I would like to believe and wrote last season about maybe the tanking era being over. It's just, it, you know, there are still teams that are incentivized to be bad for multiple years running, even with worse lottery odds, even with the appeal of trying to chase the play-in, and not all of them want to. Tillman Fertitta blew up this team. He did everything possible. I mean, listen, there's a whole other, you know, line of discussion here, but, you know, that team, that franchise suddenly became not a desirable place to be. Daryl Morey left, and other high-ranking people left. They had a whole brain drain, and Russell Westbrook and James Harden didn't want to be part of it anymore. And that followed years of Fertitta not really wanting to spend and not wanting to get into the luxury tax when they still had a chance to be really good. And so where they are right now is they are a lot cheaper and a lot worse, and they're really young. And the benefit is they will get another high pick. And while the new lottery odds means you can't just manufacture your way into a top three or the number one, you can still guarantee you're going to be, you know, a lottery team of some sort with decent odds. And they've got some interesting young players, and they're clearly okay with riding those young players, letting them take their lumps. Is that the best thing long-term for them? I mean, this is an eternal question in the NBA to me. There's a whole, you know, philosophical question here of, like, are your young players better off with some veterans around them who can show them the way? Would they be better off with John Wall out there, giving them a better chance to get to score from better positions, to be more functional? Or do you just let them have their reps and take their lumps and have their failures? They've clearly chosen that. And if John Wall doesn't have an issue with that, if he's not saying this is a problem for me, then I just don't know what other answer there is.
Yeah, look, John Wall doesn't transform the Rockets into a good team. The reason we know that is because John Wall was on the Rockets last year and they lost 20 games in a row. So it's not like he's going to make them a playoff contender. But I do think the young players there, the Rockets in general, will be better off if John Wall is in the rotation. Where I take issue with, or who I take issue with, is the league, quite frankly. I feel like they opened Pandora's box last year when they allowed the Thunder to sit Al Horford for the second half of the season. Al Horford was healthy. He was just shut down by Oklahoma City for no other reason than they didn't want to win games. Oklahoma City also shut down Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Lou Dort towards the end, but at least with them, you could point to some kind of semi-realistic injury that was impacting them. With Al Horford, he was just being shut down. So I think the league has created this monster where Al Horford did it in Oklahoma City last year. John Wall's doing it now. Maybe next year there's another team out there. This, frankly, Howard, is league-sponsored tanking. They are allowing the Rockets to be worse. And they're not allowing them to do it in the second half of the season. They're allowed to do it right off the bat. Like, the Rockets are engaged in a season-long tank. That is honestly what they're doing.
How do you police that, though, Chris? Like, what can the league possibly do to make the Rockets play John Wall? And more to the point, should the league be telling any team who to be playing and how much? Like, how do you even broach that? Where is the line of authority there, or the mechanism to enforce it?
I don't know. But at least fake an injury of some kind so that John Wall is not doing this. All right, let's move on, Howard. Couple things I want to get to that happened over the last couple of days. First, wasn't exactly Malice in the Palace in Detroit on Sunday, but you had an interesting battle between LeBron James and Isaiah Stewart of the Pistons late in the game. LeBron and Stewart got tangled up. LeBron threw his elbow, arm, his fist made contact with Stewart's face, opened up a pretty nasty looking cut. Stewart, understandably, took exception to that, and then he took it to a completely different level when he began frantically, crazily, it seemed like, chasing LeBron across the court, being pulled away the first time and then kind of circling back and chasing him down, or trying to chase him down again the second time. LeBron was suspended for one game. Isaiah Stewart got two games. Give me your reaction to what happened between LeBron James and Isaiah Stewart.
Let me start with this. I'm glad the NBA suspended LeBron a game if for no other reason than to shut up the moronic conspiracy theorists and cranks and whiners and everybody else who were like, oh, the league won't touch LeBron because he's LeBron. The league won't want LeBron to miss a game at Madison Square Garden, which is, of course, where the Lakers are playing a few hours from now while we're taping this. LeBron's going to miss.
I was one of them, though, Howard. I was kind of one of them there. I didn't really believe the NBA would sit him out for a Tuesday night NBA and TNT game against the Knicks. I didn't really believe it.
You go ahead and find me the example where the league actually decided to pull a punch and not discipline somebody to protect the marquee matchup. When does it actually happen? I know people say it all the time. It sounds right. It sounds like something the NBA would do and all their machinations. But this is the kind of thing that just like circulates all the time, sometimes facetiously and sometimes not.
So you're not a believer of the, you know, you were covering the Lakers back in the early 2000s when that Sacramento Kings team, game six, conference finals.
Don't get me started.
Now we're going on a totally different tangent.
Yeah. That was 2002, by the way. Yeah. But LeBron had to be suspended. One game was, I think, probably right. I do think there's a formula you can employ here. When in doubt, take whatever you think David Stern would have done and cut it in half. David Stern would have probably suspended LeBron for two games and Isaiah Stewart for four games or whatever. Adam Silver is a kinder, gentler NBA commissioner, and discipline during his tenure has, I think, been markedly lighter and more player friendly. But I'm glad that LeBron was suspended because, one, it was, I think, the right thing. I don't want to see him miss a game either. I don't want to see him miss a game against the Knicks at the Garden either in his only visit to New York. But it was the right thing. And hope it will not shut up all of the dumb conspiracy theories that you apparently want to perpetuate, Chris Mannix.
No. I mean, look, I'm with you though, Howard. Like, it wasn't a punch necessarily, but he hit Isaiah Stewart with a closed fist that opened up a pretty major gash on his face.
And nearly set off a brawl.
Yes.
So, out of everything that happened, right, like, you can see what was happening with LeBron. I know people are doing this, like, frame by frame. Like, he was looking at him, therefore he knew he was going to put. No, he was reacting to what Isaiah Stewart was doing to him and was trying to get him off of him and was maybe trying to elbow him or send a message back. He was not trying to punch. When have we ever seen LeBron try to punch anybody in the face? Like 19 years into his NBA career. Come on,
probably not
going to
be
Isaiah
Stewart if it's somebody. That's for sure. In a Pistons game.
Right. Like, exactly. LeBron James is not going to jeopardize himself, his own career, his team, everything else. He just got back from injury. His team's a disaster. LeBron James, of all people, of 19 years in, is suddenly going to decide, I'm going to go punch some second-year player. Over what? On a bad team in a random regular season November game? Like, give me a break, people. Like, use your heads. So LeBron reacts. I don't think he was intending to punch him in the face, but he did. And it's not about intent in the NBA sometimes when you make contact to the head, especially when it opens up a gash like that and nearly sets off a brawl. You have to do something about that. Suspending him was the right thing. One game is sufficient. Two games for Isaiah Stewart. I mean, you could have justified going longer for him because he lost his mind and he tried repeatedly to stoke this thing further and to engage in more violence that was premeditated at that point. Might be heat of the moment, but you know what you're doing. And the league definitely cannot allow that. So they could have suspended him longer and I think it would have been justified.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think you're probably right. David Stern would have suspended LeBron two games, Isaiah Stewart four or more. One and two felt kind of right to me in that moment. You did touch on something there. I mean, LeBron doesn't want to be out because the Lakers, they are a disaster. They've lost three of their last four going into Tuesday night's game against the Knicks, four of the last six. If you want to go back even further, this recent road trip, they lose to Milwaukee. They give 130 points in Boston. They get a win over Detroit, but Detroit stinks. They got two more games left on this road trip. I know you and I say a lot, Howard, that we're not going to get overly worked up about the Lakers till we get to Christmas. Are you still believing that? Or when you see this team, which is bottom third in the NBA in defense, bottom third in the NBA in offense, not really getting appreciably better for any significant stretches this season. Are we starting to get a little bit more concerned about the Lakers?
Yes.
Short answer is yes.
I mean, you know me. I'm usually Mr. Patience. Let's not overreact in the first week, the first month, the first anything. Like, especially if it's a team of the...
We're now a good month in. Like, it may not be enough time for the Lakers to kind of get it all together, but a month is not a small sample size.
If the rule of thumb in the NBA is 20 to 25 games, we're not quite there yet, right? Like, it's still a little short of that.
Yeah, but they're 9-9. I mean, they're 18 games into the season. They're almost a quarter of the way through, and this is what they are.
We're damn close. The caveat for the Lakers is, and the glass half full optimist view of the Lakers is, yeah, but we knew it would take time to integrate Russell Westbrook, and while that hasn't gone well, they haven't been able to do it anyway because LeBron missed a bunch of games and they've had injuries and they've had, you know, key rotation guys who have been out and Talen Horton Tucker just got back. You can, if you want to find the optimist view, it's there. It's shaky, but it's there. You can say, well, let's see them at full strength for a little while here and give them time to really integrate and settle in, and then we can judge them. I will accept that that argument as logical, but no longer realistic, because we're 18 games in, and because in the time that we have seen with their big three together, it has looked as bad or worse than predicted. And Westbrook, whether Westbrook is with those guys and not fitting well, or whether it's those guys are out and Westbrook is trying to still replicate what he's done in the past and be a one-man offense, it just ain't working. Westbrook is not the same guy. We've seen gradual decline over the last few years anyway. And it's, I don't think what the Lakers have is fixable. I don't think they're going to miss the playoffs or anything. I don't think they're going to be a play-in team, which is where they would be right now. They're sitting ninth in the West. They'd be a play-in team right now. They'll be in the playoffs, and they may be the, proverbial nightmare first round matchup for some higher seeded team. But I'm not buying them. I'm just not buying them now. LeBron's injury issues and his age are becoming more of a factor than they had been in the past. Can he make it through the rest of the season? If he does, can Westbrook figure out how to play effectively alongside him? Can that, creaky supporting cast hold up long enough? There's just too many questions. And I was on Zach Lowe's podcast last week and we talked about who our inner circle of contenders were at that moment. Doesn't mean it can't change. But we both left the Lakers out as of right now.
I think you have to. And it's less to me about Russell Westbrook fitting in, even though that is still the problem. How do they get better defensively? How? Like, who's returning that's going to make them markedly better? Like, is Trevor Ariza
Alex Caruso?
Really going to... Alex Caruso. Like, how many steals did Alex Caruso have in that game against the Lakers last week? I mean, that decision looks worse and worse every
They've got Lonzo Ball, too, which I know, listen, need to trade Lonzo Ball to get Anthony Davis. That's fine. But it's like when you see, like, these defensively capable guards, playing together in Chicago for a team that's suddenly looking really good.
The Caruso
not to
thing
mention what's happening in Washington.
The Caruso thing especially is just that's just money too, right? Like the Lakers who are a $5 billion franchise, like just print money out there in LA, like we're really going to worry about the luxury tax when it comes to a player like Alex Caruso who has proven that he can be a high-level guy on a championship team in LA. That's bonkers. I just don't see it, Howard. They're rolling Avery Bradley out there for like 25 plus minutes a night at this point. I mean, Carmelo, not a good defender. Kent Bazemore, he's been kind of out of the mix now that Talen Horton Tucker is back. I mean, Dwight Howard, Rajon Rondo, Wayne Ellington, Malik Monk, DeAndre Jordan is in and out of the lineup whenever they need rebounding. Like I just don't see it. I don't see this team improving past maybe like 15th in the NBA in defensive efficiency. I just don't think they have the horses to do it. And if that's the case, you're not going to beat any top-tier team being that bad defensively. You're just not.
Let me just plant this little seed right here, because we will be coming back and we will be having this discussion, I believe, again in the spring. Many times in between now and the spring, but certainly in the spring. This was potentially, and as of right now, I believe was, a disastrous offseason for the Lakers.
Yeah.
The Westbrook trade was a disaster. Letting Caruso walk was a disaster. Not going for the Buddy Hield deal. Like, they're all connected, of course. But there's a case to be made they would have been better off doing absolutely nothing, just keeping the same crew and rolling it back. And if you had to make moves, letting Caruso walk was not the right move. Trading your entire supporting cast for Westbrook was not the right move. Trading everybody you had who was defensively capable and or letting them walk was not the right move. Like this, and the bottom line too, and this goes back to your point about the luxury tax, which I agree. The Lakers, okay, the Buss family, not billionaires. A lot of billionaire owners in the league, Buss family, not one of them. But what the Lakers are worth and what they do make in their local TV deal,
yeah,
does allow them to spend whatever they want to, and they chose not to. I've said this many times. I will say it again because this is a principle that I believe every team in the NBA in this position has to abide by. If you have LeBron James or if you have any generational kind of talent, you are obligated morally, competitively, every otherly, to do everything possible to win it at the highest level every year. And especially when it's LeBron, one of the greatest players of all time, and he's in year 19 and the window is shrinking before your eyes, this is not the time to start worrying about spending an extra 10 or 20 million in luxury tax. And granted, as I always say, ain't my money, easy for me to say, but you can't. Those are not corners you cut when you have LeBron James on your roster. You are obligated to be all in at all times, and it's a mistake not to be. And the Lakers made, I think, several mistakes this
past season. Yeah, but Howard, is it a mistake to listen to LeBron on personnel decisions? Like, I don't know this to be true, but Rob Pelinka is a pretty smart basketball guy. Frank Vogel is a very smart basketball guy. Rob Pelinka constructed a championship team in the 1920 season, the bubble season. If not for an injury to Anthony Davis in the first round of the playoffs last postseason, very good chance the Lakers are at a minimum in the finals. I can't bring myself to believe, Howard, that Rob Pelinka thought it was a good idea to trade all the pieces he did for Russell Westbrook. I just can't. I think this was driven by LeBron James, who has a great relationship with Westbrook, has always admired his competitive spirit, and that's great. Like, you know, if you want that type of player, I don't mind LeBron lobbying for it, but this is where an executive needs to be an executive. He needs to be the one that constructs this team. Maybe Montrezl Harrell doesn't rediscover himself in LA in the same way he has in Washington this year. Maybe Kyle Kuzma needed a change of scenery. I think there's some merit to that, but those guys are playing great.
He needs a change of sweater. That's what he needs.
That's a different story altogether. But like, I can't bring myself to believe that Rob Pelinka thought this was a good idea. This feels like something that LeBron wanted and Pelinka acquiesced to and made this deal when, you know, look, this isn't Monday morning quarterbacking here. There's virtually nobody out there in the NBA or outside of it like us that thought this was a good idea. They just didn't.
No.
And it's and through a month in the season, it's played out exactly as people forecasted.
Yeah, two things there in terms of what everybody has said around the league. It was universal at the time of the trade. Universal. I don't think I talked to a single person around the league who thought it was a good idea to trade for Westbrook or make the deal that they made. So no, it will not be Monday morning quarterbacking. Everybody around the league, whether it's GMs, scouts, coaches, pundits like us, everybody thought it was a bad idea except for the Lakers. To the LeBron piece, because this is also the buzz around the league, anybody you ask around the league believes that it was LeBron and not Rob Pelinka who ultimately pulled the trigger, essentially. Obviously, LeBron can't literally do it, but it was the, oh, why did it pivot suddenly from Buddy Hield to Russell Westbrook? Somebody told me last week, I do not have this as confirmed. This is one person telling me this. I had somebody recently tell me Buddy Hield was already picking out his jersey number. That's how far along it was.
I can tell you Sacramento, like the front office there, you know, I don't think they said it was done, but they were packing Buddy Hield up. Like they believed that this deal was going to get completed.
So yeah, it was awfully close. Now, to your point, because I agree, whether it was LeBron calling for this, demanding this or not, the front office and ownership has to be the ones to decide this. And that's what you're there for. And yes, LeBron is incredibly influential. And when you have a player of his caliber, you should listen to him. LeBron's pretty smart, incredibly smart. And I think more often than not, he probably has great input to offer. But you are the final stop. And if you're looking at what's going out versus what's coming back in Russell Westbrook at that stage, at the risk of maybe pissing LeBron off in the moment, you got to say, listen, I hear where you're coming from, and you know, I want to do everything possible to put you in the best possible position. I don't think this is the right answer. I can't do this.
Yeah.
Rob Pelinka has the responsibility to say no. Ownership, Jeannie Buss and her advisors have an obligation to say no in that moment. So people can joke all they want about LeBron's the GM. People can say all they want that LeBron's the one who pushed for it, and that may actually be true. It certainly seems to be what the belief of the whole league is. It doesn't mean that it absolves Rob Pelinka and the front office of responsibility. It doesn't at all. You made that deal, and you're living with the results.
I agree. You got to stand up to these guys sometime. What they want and what you know the team needs are not always the same thing. Buddy Hield, by the way, shooting close to 40% from three this season. The Lakers could use a player like that. All right, let's talk for a second, Howard, about Sacramento, which is a mess for, what is it, like the 18th year in a row, something like that. Luke Walton fired this week as the head coach of the Kings, got off to a 6-11 start. They weren't playing well. De'Aaron Fox has not played well. I'll let you weigh in first, but, you know, Luke Walton was part, I think, of the problem in Sacramento, but he is not the totality of the problem in Sacramento.
No. There's only so much a coach can do, ultimately, if you've got a flawed roster or an insufficient roster, and that's what the Kings have. I think it's important, and Mark Stein made a great point in his recent column on this on his Substack about the way to view the Kings, right? Like, we're on year 800 in a row or whatever of them missing the playoffs. It's the longest drought in history. That was partially the previous owners, the Maloofs. It's now Vivek Ranadive for about half of it or more than half of it. So there's those two components, break it up into ownership eras. But then there's also front offices. And the Kings have changed front offices and coaches as much or more than almost any franchise in the league. I mean, I think it's them and the Knicks have probably been neck and neck over the last 20 years in instability. That is a large part of this. And Vivek Ranadive bears a huge responsibility for picking the wrong people and then turning it over constantly. But I will just say this. We sometimes need to narrow down our focus when we say, oh, there go the Kings again. Okay, there go the Kings again. But Monty McNair, the current GM, and his staff were hired literally 14 months ago.
Yeah.
14 months. It was before last season, remember, because we had the weird 2020. They didn't, you know, so they were hired in September 2020. So they've had two off seasons. And in that time, here are their major decisions. They drafted Tyrese Halliburton. That was a win. They drafted Davion Mitchell. I think everybody so far believes that will absolutely be a win. Two good picks. Granted, gave them a bit of a guard glut because they've got De'Aaron Fox and Buddy Hield as well. But still, those were really good picks, good players, guys who could be there for a long time. They let Bogdan Bogdanovich walk. He went to the Hawks.
That's the one that
I fault them on that one, too. We'll come back to it. Yeah. I fault them on that one, too. I think that they should have protected the asset by re-signing him. Remember, they did want to do a sign-and-trade with the Bucks, which got reported leaked too soon, which blew up the deal. They could have had, was it Dante DiVincenzo and who else? So they re-signed Rashawn Holmes. Decent move. And they've now fired Luke Walton. Oh, and they gave De'Aaron Fox his extension.
I would add one thing to that body of work. Probably should have traded Harrison Barnes last year. Like, I know
maybe.
I know why they held on to him. They thought they'd be in the playoff mix this year, and
yes.
Barnes has played good basketball, but his value was pretty high last year. I know Boston was after him. A couple of the teams were making calls on him. They probably should have offloaded him for pieces that better fit their direction.
I agree in general, Chris, that especially when it's year one of a new administration, like you are under no obligation. But I think ownership wanted to win. I think, you know, that front office probably wanted to be the ones to break the streak too sooner than later. The good news is Harrison Barnes, one, he's this much deeper into his contract. He's that much closer to it coming off somebody's books if you trade him. And two, off to another strong start. The window to cash out on Harrison Barnes to retool your roster has not closed by any stretch.
Correct.
So that opportunity's there. But the bottom line is, like, this front office has done all right. We can fault them for the Bogdanovich thing. Like, and we can talk about why they did it. I understand why they let him walk. But overall, good draft picks. Haven't made any crazy moves in terms of furthering their cap issues. Haven't, you know, sent out draft picks chasing, you know, any ghosts. Like, they're they've made good, solid short-term moves that have not resulted in a change in their overall standing because they inherited a flawed roster. At some point, you have to start making the bold moves that reshape the team. They're not there yet. I feel like they're still in this feeling out period where they're saying, well, what do we have in these guys? You know, when do we trade, if you're going to, Marvin Bagley or Barnes or Buddy Hield?
Not sure what kind of value Marvin Bagley has at this point, but yeah.
I don't know either. He's playing again. He played strong 12 minutes last night. You know, short span, but productive. We'll see. But this front office is not the one that drafted Bagley over Luka and Trae Young. This front office is not the one that gave out the massive contracts to all these guys. So, except for the extension to Fox, which I think was justified.
Yeah.
So I would just say, you know, some patience is probably still needed for this group. If you're a Kings fan, I don't blame you if you don't want to be patient at all anymore. It's been way too long. But this front office has been on the job for 14 months. Like, it's not even 2 years. And, you know, I'll be shocked. We can have this discussion again after the trade deadline. If they've done nothing at that point, then maybe people, you know, you want to start aiming the fire at the front office and saying, well, they haven't done enough to get them out of this long rut. Okay. I would expect we'll see something between now and then.
And look, they inherited Luke Walton, so this next coaching hire will
yes.
be their first coaching hire. So,
yes.
you know, every front office, you know, wants and deserves the opportunity to do that. One lesson to go back to Bogdanović for a second. I just never let an asset walk away for nothing. Never, 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 never do it. If it's just going to cost you money temporarily, because you can always trade the asset, sign a guy like that and deal with the fallout down the line. I feel the same way watching Brooklyn play without Spencer Dinwiddie. Like, where would the Nets be
yes.
if Spencer
yes.
Dinwiddie was still in Brooklyn? And
absolutely agreed.
He didn't sign some massive contract with the Wizards. It was a good contract. He didn't sign a massive deal. You couldn't predict, obviously, you know, New York City, COVID, Kyrie, all that stuff, but always keep the asset. Always
no,
keep
you,
the player and then deal with it down the line.
You couldn't predict Kyrie, but you could kind of predict Kyrie. Like,
maybe.
You
didn't know, a little bit.
Right? You know, you didn't know that it was going to unfold this way, but you've got this volatile, you know, eccentric guard. Like, something might have happened. No, I hold the Nets to the same standard and the same principle we discussed with the Lakers. You've got Kevin Durant. You got Kevin Durant and James Harden and occasionally Kyrie. You are under absolute obligation to be all in. And if that means spending, again, not my money, but tens of millions extra in luxury tax to keep Spencer Dinwiddie as an insurance policy and as a great sixth man, yes, they absolutely should have kept Spencer Dinwiddie.
Somebody would have traded for him.
You can always get out of it later if it's not working out.
Mm-hmm.
The Kings should have kept Bogdanović, I believe, as well. However, they had just inherited this new group, had just inherited a capped out, awkward roster that wasn't winning, and now you're going to spend as much or even more to keep that exact group together and lock yourself up even further, give yourself even less flexibility to unravel that roster and that cap. And so I get you don't want to lock yourself in even further to a group that's not even winning. And Bogdanović would have been probably a little overpriced. And they already had tested the market on Buddy Hield and couldn't find anybody who wanted to give them value for him. Like, I get it. At a certain point there, you go, like, enough's enough. Why are we overspending to keep the same group together that can't win? I get that. But I still lean your direction on this, which is don't let an asset walk for nothing. Somebody would have traded for Bogdanović later.
Look. To kind of make it to simplify it even further, the Kings wouldn't be here if they just drafted Luka Doncic over Marvin Bagley. Simple as that. Luka Doncic is such a great player that he would yes. have transcended them above their Kingsness, their Kangsness, to use a topical word. He would have fixed them, you know, by
himself.
Shout
out to Vlade Divac, who drafted Bagley.
Which is unbelievable. Vlade Divac, one of the great European players of this time, passes on a great European talent. Unbelievable. Still mind-blowing to me. All right, I want to finish in Boston with the Celtics. They won on Monday night over the hapless Houston Rockets, but they're now 8-3, Howard, in their last 11 games going into the showdown against Brooklyn on Wednesday. You've got Jason Tatum averaging over 30 points per game over the last four games. I love what I've seen from Marcus Smart over the last couple of weeks, where he's gone kind of away from being the volume shooter we've seen at times to being more of an efficient playmaker. Jaylen Brown made his return to the lineup on Monday after missing 8 games with a hamstring injury. Rob Williams is back in the mix. The last couple of weeks, last few weeks, Howard, the Celtics have started to look like the positive version of the team that some people expect. They've been a little bit Jekyll and Hyde to start the season, but whatever the good one is. The Jekyll? Jekyll's the good one? They've been Jekyll at this point over the last couple of weeks. What do you make of what you've seen from Boston?
I think Jekyll is the good one and Mr. Hyde's the bad one.
Correct.
But it kind of seems like it should be the, like, Jekyll sounds like an evil name,
it
doesn't
does,
it?
Doesn't, yeah.
Hyde sounds like an accountant, and Jekyll sounds like, you know, some annoying kid who's, like, you know, trying to steal your lunch money. I don't know. So, I don't know. I'll revise that one some other time. This is much closer to the Celtics team that I think we both expected. A lot of this is, yeah, Jaylen Brown missed a bunch of time. Jason Tatum got off to a really strange start this season. Both those guys, you know, they get called out by Marcus Smart a few weeks back for their ball dominance. I thought they had some chemistry issues to work out. Maybe they have. It's like winning 4 out of the last 5 and what is it, 4, 5, 6 of the last 8?
8 of 11, yeah.
And 8 of 11. Like, it definitely, it has the outline of a revival. I think this is one where I'm going to withhold judgment a little bit because they're so all over the map. They are so Jekyll and Hyde, whatever Jekyll and Hyde is, that I kind of want to wait and see. Like, there's the game against the Nets coming up. They got a bunch of road games coming up, including, you know, at Toronto, at Utah, at Portland, who have kind of revived themselves. They go the LA teams back to back. They finish that road trip at Phoenix on December 10th. They've got a home game against the Sixers in the meantime. Philly's been all over the place, but I want to see a little bit longer runway here, or a little bit more sustained success. I think Tatum's numbers over the last 4 games are incredibly encouraging. And I think the shot selection maybe has been a little bit better over that time. Like, he was settling so much early on, especially. You know, he's always been a little frustrating in that regard. But Tatum's last 4 games, averaging 33.5 points, 8.5 rebounds, 3.8 assists, which is a good number for him, and 7.3 free throw attempts. So he's attacking again and getting to the line more and shooting 38% from 3 over that span. So, yeah, it's 4 games.
The free throw attempts, Howard, is the big number with Jason Tatum. He was not getting to the line enough in the first 10 games of the season. He got to the line 9 times in the first half against Houston on Monday. That's exactly what they need for him. They need him getting to the line 9 or 10 times per game for him to be peak offensively.
Well, I think both of those guys, and again, you know, Brown was out for a little while, but, like, they're both dangerous players with the ball in their hands. They've got size and athleticism and can attack. And, like, if you're not creating free throws, if you're not putting fouls on the other team, if you are settling and making it easy on the opposing defense, like, that's not what the superstars do. If these guys are the future of that team, if these guys are supposed to be perennial all-stars, all NBA caliber wings, then the complete game has to be there. The 3-point shooting is important, but they've got to be able to attack, draw fouls, collapse the defense, open things up for teammates. That's the responsibility, and that's the talent that they have.
Yeah, they do have the talent for it, and I think Al Horford has been excellent for them, looking more like the Al Horford we saw over 3 years in Boston than the guy we saw in Philadelphia during that one season. Look, what I like the most about this team is that they have steadily moved up the rankings defensively. Right now, as we speak, they are 6th in the NBA in defensive efficiency. And I've been saying all season long, when this team was getting gouged defensively and ranked in the bottom third early in the season, that they belonged in the top 5. They have the horses to be an elite defensive team. And we have seen that over the last couple of weeks in more than just spurts, in many, many games over these last couple of weeks. I go back to Marcus Smart, too. I was not sold on Marcus Smart as the primary playmaker coming into the season. I thought he was better equipped for that dual guard role where you kind of plugged him in at both guard spots for stretches. He could be your defensive stopper. He gets streaky offensively and makes some shots. But he has really settled in to a facilitator role offensively, where he's only taking 6, 7, 8 shots on a lot of nights and handing out 5, 6 assists against 1 or 2 turnovers on many of these nights. That's exactly what you need from Marcus Smart. If you just get kind of a B-level offensive game, combine that with his A-level defense, which we saw on Saturday against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, which we saw on Monday against Jalen Green. If you get just a tidy, efficient offensive Marcus Smart, he's a really good player for this team. They don't need him jacking up 15, 16 shots every single game. They need him being a playmaker, being a facilitator, being a ball mover, and that's what he's been. That's a big reason I think they've turned it around over these last 11 games.
And it would be nice if they could, you know, find a way to acquire a solid year-in, year-out point guard whose primary or best assets are as a point guard, a distributor, and defend the position, hit the open threes, you know, like, you know, I'm not saying Mike Conley literally, but, you know, Mike Conley, who's just at this stage of his career, not a star, but just does the basics efficiently at a competent, reliable, consistent level. But what they have instead is, you know, look, Marcus Smart brings some things to the table. Dennis Schroeder has been really good for them, especially as a scorer.
Excellent.
Brings some things to the table.
Excellent for them.
If you could somehow fuse those two guys together, you'd have the guy that they probably need next to Brown and Tatum. I'll be curious to see long-term, or at least for the duration of this season, how far that 1-2 punch gets them. Schroeder and Marcus Smart bringing very different things to the table. I still feel like, you know, and this has been them for the last several years, right? From Kyrie, you know, Isaiah to Kyrie. Am I getting my order? Yes, Isaiah to Kyrie to Kemba to Marcus Smart. It's just been a revolving door, and it's been different circumstances every time they've shifted direction. It's not as if they did this intentionally. It's just Isaiah Thomas got hurt. You know, Kyrie became available. Kyrie decided he was no longer available or amenable. You had an opportunity to get Kemba, like at Kemba's knees go. Like, but that's been part of the issue here, right? When we talk about these last few years and the frustration or the frustrating inconsistency of the Celtics, that's a big piece of it. It's partially the young guys. It's partially their young stars going through growing pains. And part of it's that revolving door at point guard.
Yeah, I do think they've got some flexibility to make some deals in the next couple of months. On the bench right now, you've got Peyton Pritchard, who was a big part of what they did last year. He's not able to crack the rotation right now. Aaron Nesmith, a first-round pick a couple of years ago, he's considered a pretty good shooter. He'd be available. And Romeo Langford finally is getting it going and being part of this rotation. Right now, Josh Richardson is ahead of those guys in the rotation. So, you know, there's an opportunity here to flip some of these young players for that veteran-type player should he become available over the next couple of months. But I really like what I've seen from Boston. Ime Udoka, by the way, growing on the job too. Like, I thought he made some mistakes in the first couple of weeks. Probably should have anticipated them, right? Like, these mistakes with a first-year coach who had never been a head coach at any significant level. So I think he's started to grow in this last month, and I like what he's done with his rotations. The team is starting to really develop a defensive identity. These players seem like they're buying in at this point to what he's trying to do. So Ime Udoka, you know, who was, you know, widely viewed as the right choice for this team in the offseason, I think it's starting to show that and validate that hire in Boston. Howard, good stuff, man. Good luck on Friday. Dan Grunfeld joining Howard Beck on the Crossover Podcast. And you and I will be back here next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.